Hey, everybody, Dr. B here. This is the first episode of the podcast, which I'm really excited about. Today, we're going to delve into a 101 of sorts on families, trauma, and addiction. It's a good basis for the topics we're going to be getting into in future episodes. If you're listening to this and want to see the slides I'm referring to, feel free to check out my YouTube channel where I have video podcasts. I'll also be posting a number of other videos and resources. I do want to remind you that I have a book available. It's called When the Solution Becomes the Problem, Helping Families Struggling with Addiction and Trauma. It's available on Amazon and also on my website, drmikebarnes.com. If you want to get in touch with me, feel free to reach out on my social media or on my email, which is mike.barnes@nrtbh.com. I hope you enjoy the episode, and let's get started. Welcome to episode number one of the Beyond Addiction and Trauma, the Family Recovery Podcast. And so I thought today would be a good day to set some foundation for what most of our episodes will be discussing. And in reality, Families, Trauma, and Addiction 101 will set the stage for your growth and your healing process. And it's important to understand what it is the problem is, the magnitude of that problem, how it's impacted people, what is the reality in the lives of family members. And so I thought this would be a good way to start the conversation. And so I love statistics. I think it's important to understand the size of the problem that we're dealing with. And in some cases, it helps in the healing process to realize, boy, we're not alone. And it also helps to kind of normalize this idea that the number of families in the United States that are dealing with this and around the world is staggering. And so the statistic from 2023 is that 48.7 million Americans age 12 and older have been diagnosed with a substance use disorder, which is what we try not to use the term addiction too much anymore. A more formal discussion of substance use disorder, and there's all kinds of substance use disorders, with 29.5 million Americans having an alcohol use disorder, 27.2 million with a drug use disorder, and then another 8 million who have a co-occurring disorder or both disorders. And to put that into a context that's important is that that is 5.5 times more people than live in New York City. And so we begin to look at the number of individuals with the disorder. And the other statistic that's important is that 46% of American family members report having at least one family member who has a substance use disorder, almost half of all families in the United States, or have a close friend that has a substance use disorder. And to put it into even more reality, 1 in 10 adults in the United States have lost a family member to an overdose. So it is really important to see the magnitude of that. And the next piece of this is the magnitude of individuals who have addiction or a substance use disorder and also have a history of trauma. Brian Bride in 2007 did a study looking at individuals entering addiction treatment and found that 60 to 90% of the people that they surveyed had a history of either physical or sexual abuse, and that 30 to 50% met the criteria for post-traumatic stress disorder. When I was the clinical director at the Center for Dependency, Addiction, and Rehabilitation, better known as CEDAR, at the University of Colorado Health, it's a joint venture between the medical school and the hospital system. We did very, very copious assessments and kept statistics and really began and looked. And those numbers of 30 to 50% were exactly what we saw, that 30 to 40% on any given day had a co-occurring post-traumatic stress disorder diagnosis. And that didn't even begin to to cover the number that had developmental trauma. And I'll do an episode on the different kinds of trauma, different ways that individuals with substance use disorder and their families experience trauma. And what Nagovitz, who's a professor at Harvard, in that same year found statistically was that of individuals who had a diagnosis of post-traumatic stress disorder, 52% of men and 28% of women are estimated to have an alcohol use disorder. Another 35% of men and 27% of women developed a drug use disorder. So if we're really looking at those numbers, that individuals who have been diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder have 3 to 4 times greater likelihood of developing a substance use disorder. And so they are certainly co-occurring. The only mental health diagnosis that would be higher in co-occurrence would be depression. And so the idea that someone comes to treatment for a substance use disorder without some form of mental health disorder that is co-occurring is less and less on a regular basis. So it's important to recognize those co-occurring issues. And here are the statistics again from 2019. Individuals with a major depressive disorder, 20% will develop a substance use disorder. Individuals with a generalized anxiety disorder, 33 to 45% will develop a substance use disorder. Individuals with bipolar disorder, 30 to 50% will have a substance use disorder. Schizophrenia and other thought disorders, 47% will have a substance use disorder. And then individuals with personality disorders, which I see as being particularly borderline personality disorder, is so commonly associated with trauma in childhood that 50% of those individuals will develop a substance use disorder. So when we talk about it's important for families with a loved one with a substance use disorder who are looking for answers, that the best way I can describe it is that it's really complicated. It's, and I say this to families on a regular basis. What if this situation is far more complicated on one hand and easy on the other hand? But the idea that, why doesn't my loved one do what we want them to do? Why don't they take responsibility? And again, it's a lot more complicated. It's a brain disease, and it's another episode that we'll do, is how does it hijack the person's brain? And so, if we then look at the basics of addiction, I think it's really important to look at, if we go to a reliable source, which is the American Society of Addiction Medicine, how do they identify addiction or substance use disorders as a disease? And I think it's important to recognize that it's a primary disease, and what that means is that while an individual So Paul Early, who's a fellow in the American Society of Addiction Medicine, wrote a very good book for professionals, and he talks about that there are three ways that people become addicted, or three kind of sources. And the first is genetic, or what we term epigenetic, and the idea of how individuals who have a family history that have a genetic predisposition, the environment that they grow up in, depending on how much stress and how much conflict and how much family dysregulation there is, that certain life and circumstances can turn that DNA on, which would make it more likely for someone to have a disorder. The second way he describes it is that individuals who have other kinds of problems in which they begin to use drugs or alcohol as a self-medication process. And we see that with post-traumatic stress disorder. We see that with bipolar and other kinds of medication or other kinds of problems that clients find that if they're intoxicated, that they don't feel the pain. And then the third is just a large environmental factor, the idea that if I grow up in a neighborhood where drug and alcohol use is just highly normalized, or I grew up in a family where drug or alcohol use was highly normalized. And it's not unusual to get a young family member in treatment who says, "I don't know why I'm here. I don't use any more than anyone else in my family. How did I get into this process?" So it is a primary disorder that may have other sources as a kind of causative factors, but that once the individual has that disorder, that they have to treat it as that disorder, that fixing the trauma history or going to therapy for the trauma probably will not allow that person to just get sober. That there has to be a process of treating both issues. It is chronic, and that means like things like diabetes, multiple sclerosis, other kinds of medical conditions that are chronic are that once the individual has this disorder, that it doesn't go away. That it doesn't mean that people will continue to use for the rest of their life, but in most cases, people have to make certain changes in order to make that happen, and they have to be aware of it, and they have to pay attention to issues that may have stimulated its use at the beginning. But for most people that we treat, it's a lifelong process, very much like diabetes would be, where they have to pay attention to what's going on. It's progressive. It has a beginning, a middle, and an end. And we'll do an episode on chronic disease management. We'll talk about how that process works more. I'll show you a little bit about that here in a minute. That's potentially fatal, that people die from medical complications, that addiction impacts every major medical system in the individual's body. It is pathological pursuit for reward and relief. Again, either through it impacts the mesolimbic dopamine reward centers of the brain, and so begins to hijack the defense systems, the memory systems, to where the person begins to associate feeling good in an actively learned process with with using drugs and alcohol. There's an inability to abstain. People make promises, "I'll never do that again. I'm going to manage my use," and that they consistently struggle to do that. There's an impairment of behavioral control. There is craving, and craving is associated with neurotransmitters and the way individuals remember the using experience, so that when they're reminded of those things that they experienced when they were using, that their brain begins to release dopamine so that they can begin the process of feeling good again. A failure to recognize the problem, and that their defenses prevent them from seeing that I have a problem. Dysfunctional emotional response. It does impact everything from serotonin. There's research that says the more dopamine I have in my system, the less serotonin, which is the neurotransmitter associated with depression. And so it impacts our ability to feel certain things. And then the last part is that relapse is part of the illness. And this is a controversial point. Chronic disease management sees a lapse or a relapse as an opportunity for growth. As a not as a failure, but as an opportunity to, how do I get stronger? How do I manage this better? And so a lot of times people in addiction recovery see relapse as a failure. When I talk to families about a loved one who has experienced a lapse, we teach them, how do you have a conversation about that lapse so that it gets the person back on track, and they get back into recovery quickly. But my statement to them is, how do you have a conversation about relapse so that the relapse lasts for 3 days rather than 3 years? And an idea of I was talking with a mom not too long ago about her son who had been in treatment who lapsed. And when I asked how did the conversation go, her comment was, things were said that can never be unsaid, that it was not a positive experience, and it actually created more conflict than healing. And so these are sort of the fundamental things that family members, as you're kind of looking, particularly if you're new in this process with a loved one who's struggling, to realize that the things that you're seeing can be explained in that way pretty clearly. I think it's also important to understand that there are addictive processes that have nothing to do with drugs and alcohol that are often seen as co-occurring with a substance use disorder. And we call this addiction interaction disorder, or a term that a lot of people use is process addictions, sex, food, pornography, spending, exercise, gambling, work, all work in the same parts of the brain that substance use disorder work on. And right now, the biggest fear that we have is gambling, with most states legalizing it and colleges being supported to get their students tied into these gambling sites, that we see a significant amount of co-occurring disorder in our particularly our younger clients, but also our older clients as well. And sex and pornography are, I was talking to my clinical staff not long ago, and I said, "What do you estimate the co-occurrence of pornography addiction?" And the staff said, "Probably 40, 45%, if not higher." And so it's common that your loved one, in the process of their developing this addiction, will have other behaviors as well. And people will talk about affairs and all of those other things that happen, but they work on the exact same part of the brain as the substance use disorder. So that's an important thing to kind of recognize, that just stopping the drug or alcohol use without healing. And I think now is a pretty good time to say that in my mind, there are three levels of healing for people with a substance use disorder. There's abstinence, which basically says, I'm going to quit using. I don't think I need to do anything about that. I don't need to go to all those meetings and all that stuff. I recognize the problem, and I'll just stop. And that is very hard to maintain. Second level is what we would call sobriety. And sobriety is, I have a problem. I need to work on that problem, and I need to go to those meetings. And I need to, and when I say those meetings, there are all kinds of meetings. It doesn't have to be a 12-step meeting. It could be a church meeting or a church group or a support group. Could be cognitive behaviorally based program. I think they all have value. But sobriety is basically saying that I have a problem and I'm going to focus on that problem. The third level is what I call, is what we all call recovery. And recovery is tying sobriety with the SAMHSA wheel of wellness, and having that your loved one kind of work on their emotional state, work on their traumas, work on the relationship, work on financial stability and those kinds of things. And so it is a chronic illness that impacts virtually every area of a loved one's life. And so people will often ask, well, how do we as treatment providers understand, or how do we make a diagnosis? How do we decide whether someone needs treatment or doesn't need treatment? And you got to remember, we'll do an episode on treatment. And treatment is everything from an outpatient counselor to a locked unit somewhere where people have significant mental health issues as well as their addiction issues. And so there are 11 diagnostic criteria. And I'll go through them quickly for time purposes. And depending on the number of these criteria that an individual has or experiences, will determine the severity of their problem. So, and these are diagnostic criteria from the American Psychiatric Association's Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, fifth edition. This is our diagnostic code. Number one, substance often taken in larger amounts and/or over longer periods than intended. That the idea of is there an element of loss of control? That's the second one. Persistent attempts or unsuccessful efforts to quit or control that substance use disorder. And loss of control isn't getting drunk every time or getting out of control every time they use. In the earlier phases, loss of control is not being able to guarantee beyond a shadow of a doubt what's going to happen once they start. And so these promises that the family members often make aren't lies necessarily. They're intended, but the longer this disease progresses in their lives, the less they're able to predict what is going to happen. And their defenses that evolve from that prevent them from seeing that reality in many cases. Number three, a great deal of time is spent in activities necessary to obtain the substance, use the substance, and then as the addiction gets worse, the substance use disorder gets more and more advanced to recover from the effects if there's withdrawal associated with that. Hangovers, things like that. Number four, craving or strong desire or urge to use. That they are reminded, again, I talked about neurotransmitters and how those impact craving as we experience things that are similar to what the individual experienced when they were using, that they have a strong physiological craving or urge to use. Five, recurrent substance use resulting in failure to fulfill major role obligations at work, at a school, at home, and we begin to see disruption in the marital relationships and other relationships. Unfortunately, work is usually the last place that an individual with a substance use disorder will allow to be impacted because they need money to buy their substance. Six, continued substance use despite having persistent or recurrent social or interpersonal problems. While you think, well, any rational person would stop using if they're having marital problems like we're having, has to understand the disease process prevents them from seeing that. Seven, important social, occupational, or recreational activities that are given up, things that used to give the person a sense of satisfaction. Quit exercising, quit studying, quit, it could be virtually anything. Number eight, recurrent substance use in situations that are physically hazardous, drinking and driving, coming to work intoxicated. And then number nine, substance use is continued despite knowledge of having a persistent or recurrent physical or psychological problem. Even there comes a time when even with the alterations in memory and the alterations in our defenses, that the person begins to realize this is a problem, but I just can't stop. And so those nine are things that you have probably seen in your loved one over the course of time as their addiction, their substance use disorder has progressed. The last two are physiological. Number 10 is tolerance. And tolerance means that your loved one will ultimately need to use more and more and more of the substance that they are addicted to in order to get the same level of intoxication. And that creates pretty significant problems over time. And the most important one is number 11, withdrawal. The idea that their body becomes accustomed to having a certain level of that substance in it. And as they try to cut down or to wean themselves off of it, they have what we call a rebound effect. And so, if their drug of choice is alcohol, which is a central nervous system depressant, their withdrawal will be anxiety and agitation, things like that. If their drug of choice is cocaine or a central nervous system stimulant, their withdrawal will be much more depression, exhaustion, those kinds of things. So how do we decide how significant this problem is for a loved one? And so there are three levels. And so someone can have a substance use disorder mild, which means that they have two or three of the 11 symptoms, a moderate case, which would be four or five of the 11 symptoms, or a severe case, six or more of the 11 symptoms. And those would dictate what kind of treatment. So, someone who's mild could benefit from an outpatient program, someone who's moderate, maybe a day treatment kind of program. And again, we'll do an episode on treatment and treatment levels at some point. And then the last one is severe. And I was at our treatment center a couple weeks ago, and I was doing a similar lecture with our clients on trauma and addiction. And I went through those 11 symptoms with our clients, and I think all but about three of the clients had six or more. And so they were in the appropriate level of care. They should have been in residential treatment. And so let's talk about how this impacts family members. And so if we go to understanding kind of the impact of addiction and trauma on family systems, I think it's important to start with this is I like to use what's called Jelinek's curve. And Jelinek was a researcher at Yale University back in the 1940s and 50s, and he tried to identify a set of symptoms that would show from the earliest signs of a substance use disorder to the more serious medical signs. And so if you're seeing this, you'll see this progression of symptoms from occasionally relief using. I got to remember in the 40s and 50s, drug addiction was not an issue. It was always looking at alcohol use. So I show this not to say that every individual goes through this sequence of symptoms in this order, but to show kind of less severe symptoms moving into more moderately severe symptoms into very serious medical conditions to show that your loved one, when we say it's a progressive disease, has gone through a similar process. For the family, I always use an example of like a mobile over a baby's crib. And we know that if there's a mobile over a baby's crib and we hit one of those elements on that mobile, that the rest of the mobile shifts and moves in a constant attempt to maintain what we call homeostasis or balance. And so that as your loved one's addiction, as their substance use disorder kind of moves from the earliest phases into the middle phases, the set of symptoms will become more observable, more undeniable. And so that as the loved one is showing an advanced, beginning to advance their substance use disorder, families will be making an almost constant effort to try to address that. And we do that because we love our family members. And so oftentimes we will, try to give them more support and give them more love and attention. And as time goes on, those will shift to being more efforts to control, efforts to protect. I was talking with a mom recently who looked at this Jelinek's chart, and she said, we've talked about enabling, and I think enabling is a trauma response, and we'll get to that when we do the secondary trauma lecture or episode. But she said, I realized that early on, I enabled my son because I loved him so much, and I just thought he needed it. He needed someone on his side. And then as his addiction progressed, I continued enabling him because I was afraid of him. I was afraid of what he would do and what he was capable of when under the influence of the drugs or alcohol. And so as your loved one makes this progression, as the illness becomes progressively more advanced, the effort by the family to help them to help them begin to manage it becomes more and more geared towards control, hypervigilance, and trying to kind of maintain a sense of safety in the family. And so you have to remember, depending on the role that that person plays, if it's a partner or a co-parent or a marital partner, it's going to impact kids as that happens. If it's someone that's one of the kids, it's going to impact the marital relationship. And so the problem with, in my mind, as a family therapist, I have a PhD in marriage and family therapy and have worked a lot with traumatized families is, and addicted families is, as that addiction gets more and more advanced, the changes in how families interact get to be that the rules change, how much emotion is allowed begins to change, boundaries begin to change, daily routines begin to change. And these changes over time become more effective at helping the family manage an actively using person than a person who's in recovery. And I was talking with a client recently, and he was sober for about 11 months, and he was doing great, and he hadn't seen his mom for a while. And when he saw his mom for the first time, she gave him a big hug, and then he could tell that she was sniffing him to see if he smelled like alcohol. That rather than asking him, how's your recovery, she was doing a quick test to see how he was doing. And I said, how was that? And he said, that was really hard. I'd rather we just talk about it than those old behaviors that were the behaviors that were used when I was active in my addiction. And so it is important for families of an individual to who is in recovery to kind of shift away from the belief that, boy, my job is to support this person in their recovery efforts, to more of a chronic disease management role that says our job is to be a family in recovery. We have to change these ways that we have managed our family with active addiction into a way to manage our family into recovery. And I will do an that will probably be the second episode is really looking at the family addiction. And so I want you to just kind of see that. And if you have any questions about, have I been impacted? This is the last slide for today. And that is when we started our family program, we did an assessment of every family member that came in and asked them to kind of do a symptom rating scale. And when we look at the symptoms, family members reported feeling tired and with a lack of energy, sometimes 50% of the time, and often for another 42% of the time, feeling nervous, 50%, sometimes 44% often, feeling scared or frightened for their loved one, 48%, sometimes 23% often, feeling jumpy or restless, 55% sometimes, another 15% often, feeling guilty, 52% and 30%, having intrusive thoughts, thoughts they can't push out of their mind, 50% sometimes and 31% often, irritable, 71% often. And 18% often. And I tell you this, and I show you this to say that, when family members say to me, why are you asking me to go into recovery? Because, and the reason is because it doesn't matter what the chronic illness is. Whenever a family is faced with a loved one that has a chronic illness, that it doesn't just impact the person with the illness, it impacts everyone in the family. And again, and this information sort of supports that. And again, there's no blame, there's no shame, there is only support and understanding for how difficult. I think it's probably the most difficult thing that any family will go through. And it's impacted by a lot of things that we'll cover over the course of this podcast. So thanks for attending. I hope it was helpful. Please put your thoughts in the discussion areas. Send me emails if you have questions or information that you want me to tack on in future episodes. Thanks.